And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine, and we are on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. And I should say before much more time goes on that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest and not the University of California Regents. Today my guest is Kate Braverman. She's a native of Los Angeles and was educated at UC Berkeley during the 60s, where she was a political activist in the anti-war and feminist movements. Braverman has published 4 novels, Lithium for Medea, Palm Latitudes, Wonders of the West, and The Incantation of Frida Kay. Her other books include poetry collections and her widely anthologized short story, Tall Tales from the Mekong Delta, won an O. Henry Award and was included in Best American Short Stories 1991. Kate Braverman lives in San Francisco and the Western New York community of Alfred. She's affiliated with Alfred University. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you back.
Yeah.
So,
did we just do this?
We just did this. When did we do this? Maybe 6 months ago?
Okay, well, it's nice to do it again.
So Palm Latitudes has been reissued, and here we have The Incantation of Frida Kay again. Now, tell me about, before we talk about The Incantation of Frida Kay, tell me about the reissuing of Palm Latitudes.
Well, it's come out in paperback. It was originally finished in 1984, published in 1988, and it's come back in paperback a couple of times, and now it's out again from 7 stories. And it was a book that I wrote when I lived in the barrio, in the barrio of Los Angeles, and felt myself to be very much a true citizen of Los Angeles, which to me at that time seemed to be Spanish-speaking.
How does that work in terms of reissuing a novel? I mean, does, you know, you said it's been out in paperback with other publishers, and it's here with 7 stories. How does that happen?
Well, it happens because the book was incredibly well received, and I was interviewed by Time magazine and called the voice of the region for the book, and it had phenomenally good reviews. So there was a thing, I suppose they call it buzz, about the book. And so it's never quite died out. And then when another new book is published, publishers will often bring out one of one's old books.
Okay.
Hoping that somebody will buy it.
Yes.
And that somewhere along the line someone will make some money, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And Lithium for Medea,
that's also been reissued.
My goodness. Now, is that a wonderful thing, or do you say about time?
No, it's been reissued a couple times also. What I'm thinking is I'm sitting on this hotel bed right by the Santa Monica Pier, where so very many of my stories and novels fluctuate in and out of. And it's like my whole life is rushing over me like oceans. That's how it feels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you down here doing promo for the books?
Sort of. I don't know that a poet really or a literary writer really does much promo. I'm going to do a reading at Beyond Baroque tomorrow.
What time?
7:30.
Okay.
And it's an organization that I was a founding member of, and I will read poems that I wrote there 30 years ago now. And the first novel I wrote on the Venice Canals, a few blocks from Venice Poetry Workshop. So for me, I'm certainly having a very emotional experience. I don't know whether this has any PR value, but it's certainly putting me through the ringer.
Now, you mentioned poetry, and your writing, your fiction, very much is poetry. I was reading Palm Latitudes aloud and found the sentence structure to be very poetic and very readable. I mean, it's the kind of fiction that you enjoy reading aloud because it has poetry to it.
Yes,
it's poetry.
Well, it's written as a literary writer in particular. I write for cadence, rhythm, and sound more than I do really for how it looks on the page. Because most writers just write for how it looks on the page. And that way one idea will lead you mentally to another idea. But if you write out loud and you write for rhythm and sound, you have other dimensions open to you. And so one sound will lead you to another sound, which is not the word that your eye would have chosen. It's a more spectacular version of reality and the subconscious.
So, and I think we talked about this last time, but I don't want to assume that people listening now were listening then. So I want to ask you about plot then, because I recall you saying that you didn't think plot was your strong point, which I might disagree with, but I wonder how you reconcile the two. How do you deal then with plot when language is what you seem to be most interested in and what you do beautifully?
Well, you know, words have a way and rhythms have a way of adhering to each other in a way that I suppose perhaps for a musician, riffs come together and become composed into a larger musical piece. I'm full of verbal riffs, and they have a way of embroidering themselves into larger forms. Sometimes I just take the poems and literally put them in. And something that was interesting to me is I was reading a pivotal poem that happened after I'd been at the Venice Poetry Workshop for maybe 7 or 8 years. I wrote a poem called Some Women. And it begins, "Some women are born to sin. It's a calling like the claw for politics, a certain sensibility, a kind of music." And it was a profound sort of change of voice for me. And I've been using it on and off ever since. And it was like a seamless piece of, it was like you'd been digging in the desert and then suddenly sprang open the ocean. It was a voice that just went on forever. And I was looking at the incantation of Frida Kay, and I see how often I've written in that voice. For instance, Frida says of herself, "Some women are born criminals. It's a calling, like the cloth or politics, a certain sensibility, a kind of music. You are born with this renegade capacity. Some women have an ability to differentiate the strata of night. They are geologists of darkness. Often such women are burned at the stake or confined to lunatic asylums." And this is a theme that I've been developing for, 25, 30 years, about the idea of some women being born to sin. And what does it really mean? What am I talking about? It's nothing as trivial as sex, drugs, and rock and roll, if that, in fact, really is trivial. So, Barbara, I looked up the definition of sin. And would you like to know what it is?
Go ahead.
1, transgression of divine law. 2, any act regarded as such a transgression, especially a willful or deliberate violation of a religious or moral principle. 3, any reprehensible or regrettable action, behavior, lapse, etc., a great fault or offense as, quote, "it's a sin to waste time," unquote. 4, to offend against a principle or a standard. And I think then, seeing the Random House Dictionary's definition of sin, that the idea of a woman sinning is not at all trivial, and that the idea of what sin means to our culture Is it then not impossible to be a human being if it is a sin to waste time, to give fault or offense? Frida was a professional sinner, and so am I, in that I do not believe that I wish to adhere to religious and moral principles. I in fact wish to offend principles and standards. And I think that that's part of an artist's job, and I certainly think it's part of the job of any sentient human being.
Will you talk a bit more about that in terms of what you just said? You hope to offend. You want to offend. I mean, are you talking about art from the point of view of, if it's not controversial, can you call it art?
I don't think that controversial is a word I would use, but I think that you know, one doesn't, you know, that would be like the sensation show that they had, the Damien Hirst thing, which was controversy for its own sake.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there has to be a critical apparatus that's applied, but I think that art needs art by necessity. You don't have a choice. But if you're doing something original, you are violating the standards, the status quo. If you are examining your impulses, your reality, your fears, etc., then you are engaged in acts of heresy against the standard. Because the standard that we are not to violate or have a lapse of attention from requires some sort of profoundly obsolete, puritanical assumption that existed in a pre-Freudian world. And it's still in effect. You know, most women in particular, because there's a double standard, of course, with what women can write about and what men can write about. Men are, you know, forgiven their forays into sin, but women never are. Women still have to be good girls in books. You know, they're professional women. They're mothers. They're women who want to be mothers. They want to be essentially good girls. They essentially want to adhere to the standard and not give offense or violate. Where I would like to engage in acts of revolution in what I do, in the form and in the content.
Interesting. If you just tune in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. My guest today is Kate Braverman. She's author of Palm Latitudes and The Incantation of Frida Kay, just out in paperback. And both of these books have been reissued by Seven Stories. You know, for The Incantation of Frida Kay, your latest book, Kate, you have gotten wonderful reviews.
No, the LA Times called it shockingly bad and pornographic.
But Publishers Weekly loved it.
Uh-huh.
Library Journal.
Yep.
Others. And, you know, I mean, the LA Times, I know of LA Times resident or LA residents as well as former writers for the Times that for some reason get panned by the book review. But anyway, sometimes it just seems like it's more a personal thing.
Well, that's in part because they tend to give... I've noticed with my books how many of my books have been reviewed by people, and this is their first review.
Mm.
And I am an acquired taste. You need more than a room temperature IQ to read my books and to understand them. You need a great frame of reference. And to have someone as their very first attempt to evaluate literature take on one of my books is a failure of the... you know, book review editor, obviously.
Yes.
But these days, with books being the sort of commodities that they are, the only people that get paid attention to and have their books protected and reviewed by qualified reviewers are very, very bankable writers. But for the rest of us, anyone's girlfriend in the Metro section can review our books for $100.
Mm-hmm. Will you talk about that bankable writers, as you just said? I mean, what exactly are you talking about?
I'm talking about writers that have a established following, a name following, a certain, you know, they've been selected by Oprah Winfrey. They have whatever makes them, you know, like a bankable star versus a character actress.
Sure.
And it doesn't matter what schlock they do, they're bankable, you know, and they can stay bankable for quite some time.
Yeah.
It looks like Robert Stone's ticket just got punched on that last book because he's been out of gas for a long time. You know, once you run out of gas, it's okay if you're famous enough, because the cult of celebrity in this country is such that celebrity is self-sustaining for quite some time. For many, many people, it sustains them throughout a career.
Do you find that is more of an American thing than say European or South American?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the American way.
It's interesting, though. I must say that the last time you came on the show and this time, I get more emails from people when you're going to be on the show to ask if they can have your phone number, to ask how you're doing, to tell you that they said hi. So I would call that a following.
I have a cult following. Yeah. I have a small, literate, very devoted following. And I appreciate it. And I find it most sustaining. And people who have been students of mine, or people who, I just heard this, I was giving a reading at UC Davis, and I am available. I live in California most of the time, and I'm available to give readings at your local university or something, give graduate seminars. And she said, you know, your work gives me permission. And I said, I've heard that so many times, that my work has given particularly women permission to think a certain way, to write a certain way, to examine aspects of their personality, impulses, and behavior that they might not otherwise have done.
Hmm. You lived in New York State for, 10 years?
Yeah.
How was it creatively? Did you find it to be more or less a place to work than L.A.? Or California?
Well, I found L.A., it became impossible for me to even breathe. I could not even get molecules of air to cooperate with me. So basically, I was in the country perhaps healing. I find that I like the stimulation of a city. So I'm still living in rural, remote, western New York. But I'm mostly living in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. You're listening.
And I do like it. I think it is more stimulating, and I am writing more being in San Francisco.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Kate Braverman, author of The Incantation of Frida Kay. Earlier, you were talking about, something you were saying about poetry made me want to ask you about what becomes a poem and what becomes a story or a novel, that the poetry. I mean, can it go either way, or is it something bigger when you write a novel?
Well, obviously a novel is much bigger than a poem. Poetry moves too slowly for me, and I could take apart paragraphs of anything I've written, and they would be poems. And perhaps they were once poems. But the idea of putting in 4 or 5 years to do a book of poetry, when one could actually do 12 or 15 books of poetry camouflaged as a novel in the same period of time, I find more creative It's also appeals to my acts, my idea of the artist as a saboteur, making people read poetry without realizing they're really reading it as it's sewn into the larger narrative of a novel. And I would still prefer to take my chances on a novel rather than, I'd rather make them bigger than smaller. And they could exist on the page as separate entities, as poems, but I find it exciting to draw them out, to add the dialogue, to ask myself the questions that the poem hasn't answered because of the form it's in, like what else is going on, who else is in the room. Poetry is about a certain kind of sketch, but I also have the ability to take that sketch and go in and turn it, make it more dimensional, add more color, make it more exciting. Hmm. You know, poetry is not even part of the intellectual mainstream of American life anymore. So why bother?
Have you always had your voice? You have a singular voice, and when you started writing, was that something you worked to find, or was it just there?
I had a sense that I had a voice, and I worked very hard to find it, but the working very hard to find it didn't find it. It just came about, sort of. I had the walls dissolved experience, and I was in another dimension. And I've been there always since then. But there was a long period of just working without breaking through. And I don't know whether that work was really necessary or if I could have broken through just when the time came. I suppose the work was necessary because I did it and I did break through. And about that process, I don't know how that comes about. And I was asked a question at a reading the other night. I read at Black Oak in Berkeley, and a young fellow asked me, did you ever think that you had something important enough to say to take the time and, you know, suffer the way you do when you do real writing? And I said, it's curious, but I never thought that what I had to say wasn't monumentally important.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the infatuation with the language, and there's a certain exhilaration in just doing the work that just propels you on.
Mm.
I was talking to my husband. He was making clones in the old days. He's a genetic engineer.
Mm-hmm.
When they used to do it, you know, walking around in clouds of radioactivity. And I said, weren't you afraid? Since really what he does and what I do, we both deal with extremely toxic substances. And he said that was just the exhilaration of the work is such that you really don't think about the danger.
Hmm.
And this is, when you do real art, it's extremely dangerous because you're looking at the most frightening things that you can. You're letting your technique take you as far into the darkness as you can possibly go, and into the light.
Hmm.
You can suffer the consequences of blindness either way. You can have deformity from this work. I don't recommend it to anybody, frankly. The world has so very many mediocre and bad writers and so few good readers.
Hmm. I want to ask you more about that when we come back. So please stay with us, and all of you out there, stay with us as well. We'll be back with more Kate Braverman, and she will also read in the next half hour. So please stay tuned. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Kate Braverman, author of The Incantation of Frida Kay, Palm Latitudes, Lithium for Medea, and many other works. And that The views that you hear today are those of me and my guest and not the University of California Regents. Hello again.
See, you know, I wish that the university at Irvine would invite me down to their writing program.
They never have, huh?
Well, it was curious. I was the first person that they ever accepted in their program in both fiction and poetry in the 70s, and I decided to write Lithium for Medea instead of entering the MFA program.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to come down and share some of the tricks of the trade that I've learned. So perhaps there's somebody in the MFA program listening to the program right now.
That would recommend
that
you.
That was a good idea.
Yeah, I think it would be a good idea. It's, I'll talk about this offline sometime with you. But I wanted to ask you, though, about what you said before the break in terms of there's a lot of mediocre writers and we need better readers. I recall you saying something like that when we did that LA Times panel a year ago, April.
Uh-huh.
And some in the audience reacted. You could feel movement and some hair standing on end. But I thought that was a brave comment, and I wonder if you would elaborate.
I certainly will. There are far more people writing poetry than there are venues for poetry to be published or people who are reading poetry. There are more, quote, poets, unquote, than there are people to read the poetry. And most of the people writing the so-called poetry aren't reading poetry either. They're just transmitting, and they're just muddying the waters. And also, everyone believes that they can write a novel. Everyone believes that if they just had, you know, 6 months or a year off of their ordinary life, or if something would magically change in their routine in one way or another, they could write a novel. And it's just one way, I suppose, that art's been degraded in our society and in the way that we live in a kind of lottery reality where you feel, well, if I'm just in the right place at the right time, I can become Mariah Carey. If I'm just in the right place at the right time, I'll be Madonna. It's the world as an act of continual discovery of new celebrity. And also, everyone does feel a creative impulse. I know. I studied art. The first 2 years of my burnout when I lived in the country, I went and I studied visual art for 2 years, and I was able to immediately perceive that I did not have the necessary intuition or ambition or technical skill to be a good printmaker. And that my fellow students were throwing things away that were much better than I would ever be able to make. But still, I had that romantic notion that I could make art. I cannot make visual art. And, you know, people just can't write either. What they want to take their creativity, we need to recognize that at this point in the culture we live in, that to engage serious works of literature and read them and understand them and talk about them with other people is a valid advocation. It's a true thing to say that you do. Like, I study Italian, I garden, and I read. Very few people even list reading as a hobby anymore. And we've never needed real readers because the critical apparatus that evaluates literature has been demolished in the last 30 years. It's because the ma and pa publishers who used to care about the style of what they published and the innovation of what they published have been driven out of business by the marketplace. And now the only thing that matters is, will it sell? And as long as there are dilettante writers who are spending their time doing that rather than engaging in acts of reading, it is very hard to read. Especially in this society when there is nothing in our popular culture that encourages us to be that solitary and to work as hard as you have to read real books. I just read something, I don't know how old it was, 50, 60-year-old book, and I had to hit the dictionary every other page.
What were you reading?
I can't remember now if I was reading... I read some Thomas Wolfe. I went on a Paul Bowles binge.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that writers 50 years ago just had enormous vocabularies compared to writers now. When was the last time you had to hit the dictionary on a Margaret Atwood, Joyce Carol Oates kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Never.
Right.
It's our language has been diminished. So that to really read a serious, intellectual, courageous mastery of the page requires a great deal from the reader. This is not a TV show.
Mm.
This is a thing you have to take on faith, where you, oh, I know also what I just read that I loved was Don DeLillo's Underworld.
Uh-huh.
Which I think is a masterpiece. And there are times when I had to go back and reread 200 pages of that book. Sometimes I wanted to do it because I was so exhilarated by the brilliance of it, and sometimes because I was so lost and dazed as to what had become of the narrative, which, you know, sometimes disappears for hundreds of pages.
Yes.
And to bring to bear that sort of effort on a book is not what most readers do. I was shopping today, and I heard two women speaking in the store, and one was saying, well, I picked this up because Ofer recommended it, but, you know, if a book doesn't hit me in the first four or five pages, I don't have time. And the sales lady said, well, I don't have time either. I mean, there's so much to do. A story has to start to happen immediately. And when you read a real work of literature, it's like climbing a mountain.
Hmm.
Sometimes it doesn't even begin to show you what the terrain is for 200 pages, 300 pages. It should hurt.
But what do we do about that when you have... you have publishers, you have literary agents. Well, it all seems to begin with the agent who is inundated with material. They don't have time to go to page 200 to see if it's going to work. What do you do about that when it has to begin there if it's ever going to find its way to the marketplace, you know?
Well, I don't think about the marketplace when I write, so I can't answer that question. You know, there are two kinds of writers. They're the kind who write about a world that everyone already knows and understands and is highly marketable, and writers who write as an act of discovery and revelation and alchemy to invent and examine something that has never existed before. And I don't think that there aren't agents who will read it. I think that agents will read it. I think that the disappointment comes in the difficulty of getting it published.
Hmm.
And that agents, will take a certain amount of no on a book, and then they move on.
Yeah.
And I feel that the fault is not necessarily with agents, who would just as soon, in many cases, see that a spectacularly good piece was published than an act of mediocrity. But the marketplace dictates everything that happens in America.
Hmm.
And what would I tell a writer? I would say you need to know whether you're an artist or whether you're a writer. And if you're a writer, I can't help you.
And if you're an artist?
If you're an artist, then you have a vision, You have a necessity. You have a private lexicon, which you can no more violate than you could, you know, chop your fingers off slowly. It's not possible to do other than what you do.
Will you read to us, Kate?
Sure. I love that blues. Was that your husband playing that?
That was him.
Okay. Well, while he was playing the blues, I thought I'd read a blues.
All right.
And this is called Winter Blues.
And, this
and you
is,
kind of can imagine it as a blues.
And I'd like to say again, we are talking with Kate Braverman, author of The Incantation of Frida Kay and many, many works, and she's about to read.
And we don't know what it is. Let's not call it anything. It's just called Winter Blues.
All right.
The women are extravagant with lace and sadness. They listen to Lady Day incessantly. They, too, wear flowers and the tooth marks of tiny metal needles. Love is killing them. Love is killing them. Love is killing. Love is killing them. See, I need a chorus for that. People coming in unison at different times with different effects. They buy French negligees to weep in. They wait at cold windows in high-heeled satin sandals, fixed like moths in reverse, drunk on the draft. Their feet turn blue. Love is killing them. Young men refuse them, saying they hate women that cling, so their arms fall off. They are exquisite with silence, undemanding as a vase of out-of-season gardenias. They chart their abandonment, glistening empty shell of vodka and heroin. They know what it is to be limbless, to bury a father, to cross the damp grass, select the plot. Their children don't call. It's been 9 years since that cruise to Jamaica. They do not expect marriage proposals or hand-painted dolls of porcelain in a Christmas stocking. They're no one's girl. That's how the cards fell. Seven of Cups. The King's upended. They keep going, polishing their scars, begging for love, saying, give me a postcard, a trinket, a pat on the head, a promise, even if you break it. Night is damned by hidden gas lamps. Chill is the rain into basement rooms where forbidden seances are held and the occasional dead enter, edgy as insomniacs, nerves bitten raw by worms, flesh diaphanous as incense. Such women are tough as glass. Sing to them, and they shatter.
Hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a blues.
That's
can you
wonderful.
See it's a blues?
I can see that. And you're a wonderful reader.
Well, thank you. I've always enjoyed performance art.
Read again. Read to us again.
Okay. I'll find another poem in here. I think I should read something that I wrote a million years ago.
Okay.
Since I'm at the right here where I wrote it in Venice, I wrote this. And I just have to find it. In the meantime, I want to tell you how much I enjoy talking with you and that you make it easy. Do you do this every day?
No, I do it once a week, every Thursday.
Uh-huh. You find another artist or writer?
Yeah, people, writers that I want to talk to. You know, it's interesting because I get so many books sent to my house now for the show, and it does, you know, a lot of big-time authors as well, and, you know, it's all about the work and the writer, and if the writer is more of an artist than a commercial quantity for me. You
know. Okay, this is called Spell, and I wrote it when I was at the Venice Poetry Workshop and when I lived in Venice, a few blocks from where I am right this second. And I wrote it, and I thought it was a spell. It rained the rain of curses and world's end. Puddles erupted in the plaza, outside the cathedral in Palma, in an unnaturally windy October, 2 months before you left me, at Christmas, in Los Angeles, my hands frozen on tinsel, breathless and stunned, gasping for air. I was one entire year drunk with grief. May you have a nest of squalling infants, stupid women, plants that die, illness, and the endless redress of sunset. Once, I loved you softly, lazy as a wife hanging sheets in noon sun, accepting the parallel lines of our life. That impossible balancing act. May your autumn be indecently callous, prolonged and broken. May winter strike without warning, a series of sponge-thin afternoons withering and spilling their guts on your lawn. May you be empty and cut, and know the moon is a monster and night poisonous, black as a sea of rats. May you sleep with fever and splintered dreams, and sense me, incandescent with the grandeur of unspeakable malice, I will you in this life and all others.
Thank you. You are listening.
That sense that you can actually alter the orbit of worlds by your words is what keeps an artist fueled. And I feel the intensity of that piece now, 30 years later, and its truth and its burn.
Does your work tend to have a lasting effect for you, like this piece you just read, or might you pick something up that you wrote 5, 10, 15, 30 years ago, and you go, what was I thinking?
I don't tend to do that, what was I thinking, with it. I tend to be amazed that I could have told so much truth. And the way you do it is, at the time, it seems like you have just bare approximations, like headlines. But what happens is that to these headlines, time comes and eats the edges and the sides, and it eats everything else, so that there's the only thing that really remains are the headlines as time passes. And then when you look back, I cannot believe that I knew that much, that I dared to examine that much, and that I actually got it down on paper. And I think that you camouflage the truth that you're telling by knowing how you've changed things and invented things and omitted things. But still, I find myself amazed at having seen it and lived through it.
Your work is so packed with details that I wonder how they all get in there. I wonder if you are constantly observing, if you are constantly paying attention to get so many details on the page.
I used to, and I always had my writers walk around with notebooks of sounds and smells and portraits and self-portraits, and do 5 pages on a tree and do 5 pages on a door, to understand that it's not the actual details but the invented details. Take a painting as an exercise and tell me everything that isn't there. I can see what's there. I can see it's an old lady in a chair at a table with some flowers in a vase. Your job as a writer is to tell me what isn't there. What are the sounds in the street? What is she thinking? What did she dream last night? What can she smell from that room? What season is it? What time of day is it? And then you find that as you develop your technical abilities to do this, that it becomes fluid and that you're not really looking at anything after a while. In fact, I have a new study in San Francisco, and I planted a garden outside my study, and now I got curtains because it's too much. I really don't want to look at that garden when I'm working.
Hmm.
I really would just like to look at a gray slab.
Really?
Yes. There's just too much going on to actually be dealing with roses and bougainvillea, frankly.
Oh, we have a few minutes left. What do we need to talk about here before we go? What would you say to someone who is hoping to be an artist who is a writer? What would you tell them in terms of how to serve their internship, what to do, how to prepare?
Oh, there's so much. One of the hardest things is to get rid of the censor that lives on your shoulder that says daddy wouldn't like that, and that's a violation of someone I know, and oh, that's a sin to examine, and no, I won't go there, and to train the voice that says yes, I will go there, because others haven't, and because it's exciting, and they should find someone extremely good to study with. And the only people I would recommend, if you can't get into one of the top 10 MFA programs, I really wouldn't bother with it. And then to find somebody great that you can study with over a long period of time that you can believe in, like they were your parent, perhaps. To not share your work with anyone outside of your writing group, because once you really begin to write, that's another thing. Everyone thinks they can write because people can spell and put words down on the page, whereas not everyone can play a musical scale or mix a palette. But when you really begin to write, your husband or your daughter or your neighbor has no more idea about what you're doing than if you were studying German or Coptic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They're not in a position to evaluate your progress. And I was very fortunate to have the Venice Poetry Workshop at the time that I did, and I was fortunate to have the energy I had in Venice at that time and to be in an environment that was that creative. And I would say that it would be helpful to, you know, get to Stanford, Iowa, Irvine, and to go into an MFA program and not only know what you need to learn, but most importantly is to know what you need not to learn, and to take your time incredibly seriously. There's this idea that when you tell people you're writing, it's like you didn't say anything to them, and they keep talking. You know, unlike if you said, I have to go to the office now, or I'm changing a diaper, or my pot is boiling over. And people, like, let you go. But when you say, I'm writing, it's like you're basket weaving, mm-hmm. and they ignore you. So I think you need to really develop a capacity for solitude and for doing very little with the outside world, because during the long apprenticeship to learning to write, which takes, 6 or 7 years anyway, you really have to give up most normal social activities to have the time to write, think, do exercises, and read.
Hmm.
So, I mean, does a person really want to do that? Do you want to make that kind of commitment with the idea that the odds are statistically that you'll never make a living from it, and that it's very painful and it's bad for your health? You know, being surrounded by the kind of toxins that one encounters by going inside with a scalpel on a daily basis is perhaps not what one really ought to be doing with one's life.
Hmm. Kate, tell us again where you're going to be.
Beyond Baroque, which is in Venice on, I think it's Venice Boulevard, 7:30 tomorrow. And I'll be there in person. And you can send my emails on to me, Barbara.
I don't have your email address.
Well, at the break, I'll give it to you.
Okay. Thank you so much again for being here. You are, I find you artistically inspiring, and I love talking with you. So thank you, Kate.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Kate Braverman talking with us from Venice, California. And again, she'll be at Beyond Baroque tomorrow night. I'd like to end with a quote by Edna Ferber, who said, "A writer's working hours are his waking hours. He is working as long as he is conscious, and frequently when he isn't." You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk with you next week.